Do you ever struggle with remembering details from your travels? Then I've got something special for you. How would you like a better way to keep track of all the things you see and experience in Scotland? A way to keep those special memories and all the details fresh for years to come? My new Scotland Travel Journal might just be what you need. It includes daily journaling prompts to help you start writing about your day, lots of space for doodling and notes, prompts to reflect on your trip overall, and suggestions for things to do that help you make more meaningful connections with Scotland. There's also inspiration for your travel bucket list, a map to draw your route, space to keep track of your travel details, and some Gaelic and Scottish phrases to try while you're here. All you have to do is print out the journal, fold the pages in half, and start writing. The Scotland Travel Journal is the perfect companion for your upcoming trip to Scotland. Find it in the Watch Me See online shop or visit the link in the show notes. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello there, and welcome to Wild for Scotland, a podcast full of immersive travel stories from Scotland. I'm your host and storyteller, Cathy Kamleitner. Wild for Scotland helps you connect with Scotland, its people, wildlife, landscapes and histories. In every episode, I either whisk you away on a beautiful adventure or introduce you to inspiring locals and their stories. In between, I share my top tips for your own Scotland trip and how to follow in my footsteps. So lean back and enjoy. Let's travel to Scotland. Back in December, I stole away for a winter weekend on the Scottish east coast. My plan was to explore Fife in all of its wintry glory. I'd hoped for crisp and ice-cold winter days, ending in those glowing sunsets Fife is so well known for. But the reality was a bit more dreich than that. In today's story, we explore why I still had a brilliant time in Fife and what you can get up to when you visit the area during the colder and darker winter months, regardless of what the weather does. We'll learn about Fife's ancient history, indulge in local food and drink, and hear from tour guides and local businesses about what makes Fife so special to them. This is Icons of the Kingdom. Imagine for a moment that it's summertime and you're preparing veggie skewers for a barbecue. You're peeling an onion and carefully separate the individual layers, pulling one thin layer after the other until they reveal the heart of the onion. Now, forget what I said about it being summertime, and you get a pretty good idea of my recent winter trip to Fife. Only that instead of separating layers of onion, I got to peel back the layers of history and culture that make the Kingdom of Fife such a special place to visit. Fife is known for many things. Its industrial heritage and mining communities, as well as the medieval royal history and pilgrimage sites. It's the birthplace of golf, home of the famous Fife Coastal Path, and thanks to an innovative and ever-growing food and drink scene, somewhat of a larder for Scotland. With every place you visit and every corner you take, another layer peels back, revealing fascinating history, surprising flavours, fresh adventures and epic discoveries. And for 3 days, I got to immerse myself in all of that. My journey begins where my last trip to Fife ended, in North Queensferry. It is, in many ways, the most natural place to begin any journey to Fife. When you look at the map, you can see the village sticking out into the Firth Forth, like a hook. And it's here, at the narrowest bit of the water, that people have crossed into Fife for many centuries. Nowadays, they do this by one of the three bridges connecting South and North Queensferry. The one that stands out the most is the rusty red railway bridge, a cantilever bridge that was completed in 1890 and still carries up to 200 trains across the water every day. It's made from steel, and at the time it was built, it was the largest bridge of its kind, a real feat of Victorian engineering. And thanks to that, it was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But before this bridge made crossing the Firth of Forth accessible to the masses, and in fact for several decades afterwards, the water could only be crossed by ferry. And one of the main reasons for anyone to cross into Fife was to follow a medieval trail of pilgrimage to Dunfermline and St Andrews that was partially inspired by Queen Margaret, who in the 11th century founded the church that would later become Dunfermline Abbey. And that's how Queensferry got its name. My tour guide through the village, Andrew Simpson, tells me more.
And you hit it straight away as soon as you arrive. But the thing that's interesting about North Queensferry, that a lot of people don't really, well, they know it's here, but they never come into it because the roads and the railways take you past it. So unless you make a conscious decision to kind of come down into it, then you're not, you know, you're not really appreciating it. And because it's a dead end as well. But that's the interesting thing. It's a dead end now, but it wasn't a dead end hundreds of years ago. It was very much part of this passageway, you know, a ferry crossing created by Queen Margaret for pilgrims and for her own use as well. You know, so it was incredibly important, but now it's more the things go over the top of it rather than kind of down into it. But of course, the train station we still have, so which is a good way of people to get here as well. So Queen Margaret established a ferry crossing here. So Queen Margaret was married to Malcolm Canmore, Malcolm III. And at that point, so this is around about the 1060s. At that point, Dunfermline was the capital of Scotland. It was the capital of Scotland until around about the 1400s. Hence, its important buildings that are there, like the Abbey and the Palace. So the ferry crossing was established by her for pilgrims who were making their way to St Andrews, which was a huge ecclesiastical centre in the northeast tip of Fife, to aid their journey. And so this is the first point that they would have seen when they stepped off the ferry into Fife. And then they would have followed the path, the Pilgrim's Way, as it's now been, you know, called, a new path that's following the old route all the way to St Andrews to take them to the religious buildings there and their pilgrimage end. And then over time, this developed into, you know, an obvious crossing point for centuries and centuries. At the time of Queen Margaret, there were lots of important people coming back and forward through this point, kings and queens, you know, courtiers, nobles, and as I say, shortest point in the river, the narrowest point between two land masses, so an obvious place to have a ferry crossing. And as I say, continued all the way, well, the last ferry ran in 1964. Wow. So maybe not to this pier, but that arriving on the south side, on the southern tip rather, of Fife, has gone on for generations. And although, as I said before, people aren't necessarily arriving into North Queensferry anymore, it's still your first point of entry. You know, if you look at a map of Fife, you see North Queensferry kind of sticking out as the southern tip, and all your bridges basically converge here on the north side. And I think that, you know, not only did you have Queen Margaret coming and using this point as a crossing point, but strategically it was very important throughout the centuries. So in the 1600s and 1650s, you have Cromwell occupying Scotland. The Battle of Inverkeithing happens just round in the next bay. This area is very important strategically. And also in the Second World War, First World War as well, Rosyth Dockyard is just a little bit further west from where we are now. But also during the Second World War, the first air raid off the Second World War, 1939, was up the River Forth, trying to get to Rosyth. The Forth Bridge was obviously a key strategic point as well, and it was covered in barrage balloons throughout the Second World War. And if when you sometimes go for walks on the coastal path, you can see these little metal rings, and they were where the barrage balloons were tethered to. So there's so much kind of history through the ages, from way, way back to that medieval point all the way up to the present day, that North Queensferry, you know, has these stories to tell. And it's not always completely obvious. And when we walk around, I'll point out a couple of things that you wouldn't necessarily know were there. You know, they're not big, huge, big monuments, but they tell the history of North Queensferry and the people that were here.
It's a secret place.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
So we can
We follow the Forth Bridges trail through the village as Andrew tells me stories about the past. From the old railway pier where ferries would dock to transport the contents of train carriages across the water, to the tiny cemetery reserved for sailors and workers of the ferry line. We walk past the Brigger's Memorial, which pays tribute to the 73 men and boys who died building the bridge. And we cross under the enormous North Tower, so close you can almost touch the steel tubes, while trains keep rumbling above our heads. North Queensferry is where Victorian engineering meets medieval history. About 20 miles further east, though, I can peel back those layers of history even further. I'm in East Weems, a small coastal village that is framed by former coal mines. I'm greeted by Sue Hampstead, who is the vice chair and chief tour guide of the Safe Weems Ancient Caves Society. The name Weems comes from the Gaelic word for caves, and that's what I'm here to see. The coastline around here is littered with caves that were formed at the end of the last ice age. Sue tells me that the land we're standing on would have been covered by ice that was up to 1 kilometre thick, and as the ice melted, it carved into the soft sandstone of this coast. But that in itself is not what makes this place so unique. We've entered the first cave, closest to the car park. It's dark inside, especially on this streak and windy day, and all I can hear is the pigeons cooing above our heads and the waves crashing against the seawall. I watch as Sue fiddles with her bag and produces a small handheld torch. She switches it on and points it straight at the wall in front of me. My eyes, only just adjusting to the darkness around them, struggle to see what she's trying to show me. But as soon as Sue takes 2 steps to the right and changes the angle at which the light hits the wall, I see it clear as daylight. The carving of a Pictish double disc with a decorative line between them. The Picts were a group of people who populated Scotland more or less between the Romans and the Vikings, although much of their history is shrouded in mystery. You can find their traces all over Scotland, in the remains of Pictish forts and brochs, and also in carvings like these here on the walls of the Weems Caves. The symbols carved into the rocks are typical for Pictish carvings. There are double discs and Pictish beasts, hunting scenes and arrows, and animals like dogs and fish. But the stories they tell aren't always clear.
2 circles, which kind of joined there.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a double disc for obvious reasons. We don't know what anyone, the Picts in the past called them. That's just what we call them for convenience, because we don't know the explanations behind them. But here it's combined with what we call a floriated rod running through. Now, because we've got no kind of Pictish writing that goes with this, then we can't say, yes, this is what they were signifying with this, and same as, with all their symbols. So we have to just imagine, and there's, loads of different explanations people have dreamed up. We probably never will know unless a Rosetta Stone of Pictish writings comes up, I guess my favourite would be, because it's 2 circles that are joined, maybe this represents a marriage between 2 people. You'll see this rod running through. It's got these budding branches at the top. So a symbol of fertility, maybe. So perhaps that's, the celebration of a marriage and wishing it fertility. Often you get other things combined, so symbols often come in pairs rather than alone. So perhaps they signify which tribes and stuff like that. You know, there's so many different ideas. Yeah. So that's just one example.
It must have been significant enough, because I imagine even though it is sandstone, it would take quite a long time to make a carving like this.
It is a soft rock, so it doesn't. It possibly doesn't take as long as you might imagine. Yeah, but and the way they carve is quite particular, because you'll see you get kind of rounded outlines there. That's because they're not just kind of scoring it. What they do is chip out an outline and then smooth it over, so that you get this kind of U-shaped groove, rather than a V-shape, which you get from, you know, other methods of carving. So that is, you know, typically how they would do it. Other double discs. What's a little bird there? A goose? I think it's possibly a goose or a swan. And notice, if you just saw that on its own, you'd have no idea it was Pictish. They did carve things that were recognisable like that, but you know, anybody could have carved a goose, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But because they have this symbolic language, you know, we know when we see the double disc, we're talking about Picts, and also these little crescent shape, that's typically Pictish. And this one you won't be very impressed with, but we know what it is from the information that the Victorians left us, because they came and investigated and, recorded, sometimes photographs, sometimes drawings, all the carvings they found. And this is a very common Pictish carving, which is of a Pictish beast. So this is the head, this end.
Okay.
So this beast tends to have this kind of elongated nose.
Mm-hmm.
And the peculiar thing is it's got these feet that curl backwards at the end. So you see the legs there and the curling backwards? That is, you know, one thing that makes it a Pictish beast, because there isn't a real creature like that. So this beast, whatever it's supposed to be, comes out of the imagination. And again, people have different ideas. Oh, it's supposed to be a goat, oh, it's a dolphin, or things like that. But I like to associate it with this very rich tradition of storytelling in Scottish folklore, you know. And I think myself that they may go way, way back, these stories of Selkies and Kelpies and things like that. And I imagine them, you know, sitting around the fire and telling these stories and actually, you know, bringing out some of these creatures they'd imagined in their carvings.
We keep exploring. There are more caves along the coast and many more carvings to see. In fact, the East Weems caves contain the largest collection of Pictish inscribed symbols in one place. Unfortunately, many of them have been damaged over time, and the caves themselves face serious threats due to landslides and rising sea levels. That's why the work by the Save Weems Ancient Cave Society is so important, to save this iconic historical layer of Fife. The next day, it's time for a new adventure. Let's return to the image of the onion for a moment, but imagine instead of peeling off layers, you're putting them on. That's essentially what I did for a wintry day on the Fife coast to enjoy some outdoor adventures. When I think about winter-friendly activities that boost your well-being out in nature, three things come into mind. Being exposed to the elements on a brisk walk, taking a brief dip in the ice-cold sea, and surrounding myself with beautiful plants. My day begins on the grounds of Cambo House, a grand estate on the outskirts of King's Barnes. The sprawling gardens are crisscrossed by paths, and I follow one of them along a gurgling burn down to the shore. King's Barnes is one of many villages on the Fife Coastal Path, a long-distance trail that runs the entire length of the Fife Coast and makes the shoreline easily accessible for locals and visitors alike. Here in King's Barnes, the trail is wedged between a long sandy beach and a local golf course. The path is sandy and a slightly red colour, probably from the iconic red sandstone that makes up much of the rocky coastline of Fife. It's framed by tall grasses that covered a narrow gap between the trail and the steep slope towards the beach. At this time of the year, the grass is almost completely dry and drained of colour, turning a lovely shade of yellow-white that adds some brightness to this blustery morning. I can hear the wind rustling, the stems crackling beneath my feet, and the waves crashing on the beach. On the trail and down on the sands, there are people in brightly coloured rain jackets walking their dogs. This is their backyard, and I feel lucky that I get to enjoy it too. I can't see it from here, but my next destination is less than a mile away, at the other end of the beach. As I arrive, I meet my friend Gemma, who's joining me for this portion of the adventure. We cross the car park and follow a grassy path around the corner where a small wooden cabin comes into view. Smoke is rising from its stainless steel chimney, and a few people are standing outside getting dressed. A sign next to the door reads, "Sauna in use." And now it's our turn. We get undressed in the small space outside the sauna door until all we're wearing is our swimsuits. The temperature dial on the wall reads 75 degrees Celsius, which is about 170 Fahrenheit. Gemma opens the glass door and we're hit by the sound of a crackling fire and the wall of hot and humid air. Not wanting to let too much of it escape, we step inside, close the door, and sit down on the wooden benches. Saunas offer an array of incredible health benefits. They reduce stress and promote relaxation, allow you to unwind, and are a great way to boost your immune system. In addition, the Wild Scottish Sauna here at King's Barnes also offers stunning views of the beach through a large picture window on the wall. I sit in the heat and watch as the clouds and the sky change colour and direction. Every now and then, a patch of blue sky reveals itself, and the sun is almost poking through. When we get too hot, the sea isn't far. We close the sauna door behind us and run down the sandy path. The water is cold. Waves are crashing against my legs, shooting spray up towards my upper body and face. I barely manage to submerge myself in the water before I start running back up the beach for another round of heat. Back and forth we go, mixing hot and cold, rejuvenating our souls while unwinding our minds. To say it was blissful would be an understatement. This might just be the most amazing experience I've had on my travels around Scotland. If you ask me, every beach should have a sauna. Refreshed after our sauna session, I make my way to complete my trio of outdoor adventures. You might think that gardens don't have much to offer on a dreich and cold winter's day. But when you arrive at Cambo Gardens, I encourage you to think again. I meet with Kerry Ivins, who's showing me around today. At the heart of Cambo Gardens lies a historic walled garden that dates from the 1800s, filled with flowers, roses and grasses. Surrounding it are an edible vegetable garden, an orchard and sprawling woodlands. Six gardeners share the task of looking after the grounds and making sure that there's always something interesting to look at. The old stables have been converted into a cafe and visitor centre, and a small shop sells everything from plant seedlings to grow at home to dried cut flowers from the walled garden. The highlight at this time of the year, though, is a tiny white flower that grows close to the ground. Its arrival is highly anticipated year after year and symbolises the nearing end of the long, dark winter season. I'm talking, of course, about the snowdrop. Cambo has long been famous for its collection of snowdrops, which contains hundreds of varieties, and the annual Snowdrop Festival is a great time to visit. Kerry tells me more.
So this area was really developed as a showcase for the snowdrops. So Cambo's really famous for snowdrops, and that originated because of snowdrops in the woodlands. So people would come right from the 1930s to come and have basically a snowdrop walk in the woods. And then Catherine Erskine developed that further by building up a collection of specialist varieties of snowdrop. So, you know, snowdrops aren't all the same. There's hundreds and hundreds of varieties because they kind of mutate really easily. So it means that there's a special name for people who are very into snowdrops, which is a galanthophile. And one of our gardeners, Callum, is an absolute galanthophile. So you'll actually see, I'm not sure we're actually going to see, there are some that come out in the autumn, but I think they're, not sure if we will see any, but all these metal uh-huh. labels? These are where all the specialist varieties are coming through. So you'll see they're beginning to come through, but they're not actually there yet. So people come far and wide. Oh, look, there we go.
Oh, there's one.
Yes. So during February and early March, you know, thousands of people come to visit, and we're part of a national snowdrop festival, so we have lots. And it's all about, because it's February, people have been stuck in the house. You know, it's all what we were talking about earlier, people getting out, having a walk. They're a symbol of hope, sort of like the new growth, the new season, all of that good stuff. So we put on lots of different talks and events and things around that. But yeah, the humble snowdrop, so...
They are such a beautiful sign, and like you say, they are kind of the first flower that come out at the end of a very long winter.
Winter, exactly, and people are really, you know, exactly, really sort of...
It's quite exciting.
Get that, exactly.
You know that things are going uphill from there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when I first came to Cambo, I didn't realise that there was more than one type of snowdrop. And now I know that there are many, many, and ones that flower very early, and then obviously the ones that flower in the sort of standard sort of February, March time. Yeah, so I guess we try and have a balance between appealing to the real galanthophile, so you get, there's a very, very specialist audience. So this year we've got a specialist called Michael Myers coming, who's going to do a sort of keynote talk. We did a really nice event last year, which was the full moon in February. It's called the Snow Moon. So we did a sort of candlelight event where we lit up, just was like tea, very, very lo-fi tea lights in china cups, all sort of dotted around all the snowdrops. So there was just this amazing glow, and it was the full moon, so people could come for a walk, sort of, and just that, again, that connection with nature, nothing, no frills, just moonlight, snowdrops, and a few little candles, and it was like the most sort of special kind of moment, yeah.
It's my last day in Fife, and after pulling back the layers of history and adventure, it's time to focus on the tasty side of Fife. My journey takes me to Ardross Farm Shop between Ely and St Monans. The shop is small, just two rooms taking up the lower floor of a stone-built barn. But the shelves are stuffed to the brim with everything you might need in your kitchen. There are baskets piled high with mushrooms, boxes of squash, bundles of curly kale, and tall stalks of Brussels sprouts leaning in the corner. The air is filled with the scent of sourdough loaves and freshly cut herbs hanging on the walls. The fridges and freezers are filled with meat from the farm and locally sourced cheeses. On the shelves, I find many place names that sound familiar. Chocolates, biscuits, chutneys and jams that are produced right here in the villages around Fife. Claire Pollock is the head farmer here at Ardross Farm, and she tells me that her parents started the shop with just a couple of freezers at a time when farm shops hadn't gained in popularity yet. Back then, the farm was struggling to make ends meet, so the shop presented an opportunity to cut out the middleman and sell their produce directly to the people of Fife. And the recipe clearly paid off. Since those early days, the farm shop has grown immensely and is now one of many that bring good local food to the people of Fife. After telling me about some of her favourite Scottish products they stock, I asked Claire why Fife in particular is such a foodie destination.
Fife and why food?
I don't know. I think Scotland had a really bad reputation for a while there of being deep fried Mars bars and horrible food. And I think we've really, really upped our game now and become quite a foodie destination. And I think this area, is, as far as farming and fishing is concerned, is really big in this area, which I suppose is filtered into the food. Mm. But there is just so many diverse businesses around about here that it's wonderful.
There's a lot of young people who kind of, I guess, move up here as well and see that opportunity to start something new. And yeah, it's really exciting to see, actually.
Yeah, it's just, it's a lovely area. Like, we all grew up here, obviously, and I think we take it for granted for sometimes. We get customers in the shop that come in and say, I can't believe you live here. This is wonderful. And it does make you kind of step back and think, yeah, we do stay in an amazing place. We should not take that for granted.
Really, really lucky to have access to such amazing locally produced food. Thank you very much.
Another one of those young and innovative food ventures in Fife is Bowhouse. And as luck should have it, I'm here in time for one of their bustling market weekends. Just like the Pollock family at Ardross Farm, the team behind Bowhouse want to connect local food producers directly with consumers. Their monthly market weekends are an opportunity to meet farmers and food producers and hear the stories behind the things we eat and drink. I find a spot in the busy car park and make my way over to the market. It's located in a big old farm, with a few permanent shops and cafes and two large market halls. One of them is filled with tables and seating, surrounded by a circle of food trucks, and the band is playing tunes. I order a vegan hot dog and sip from a steaming cup of mulled cider while I watch the hustle and bustle of the crowd. Over in the other hall, there are rows upon rows of market stalls where local food businesses sell their treats. You can buy loaves of bread, small wheels of cheese, and jars filled with kimchi or jam. I speak with a farmer about honeyberries, a new superfood that originates in Japan but grows well in Scotland, and pick up a couple of bags of Pitt & Weem hot chocolate to enjoy later when I'm back home. I also meet Rosie Jack, who's the manager here at Bowhouse. I mention how different it feels to shop here as opposed to the supermarket, being able to ask questions about the things that I buy, and she tells me more about the relationship with their producers.
I love how you explain and describe the relationship that you have with local producers, and you know many of them have been with you for a very long time. Can you kind of try and encapsulate what it means to them to have this space, to have this opportunity to be part of a market like Bowhouse?
Yeah, definitely. I think, like you say, it's been a long-standing relationship we've built up with them, and we try and have a two-way conversation. If we're making changes to market or plans and rules, we want to make sure that it works for them. I think we especially saw during COVID that many producers, all of their routes to market stopped and closed. And we felt it was really important to support them in different ways. We were able to keep running some of the markets at a smaller level and set up other routes to market for those producers. But for us, I think there's so many big, massive companies out there, but we really want to support the small guys that are making amazing products and really want to showcase that to their local community, their Scottish community. So that's really important to us, and that's always at the core of everything we plan and try to create at the market weekends.
And so this was obviously the last market of the year. The Christmas market kind of finalises your programme for the year. Your next market is in March. Can you tell us a little bit about what people can expect? And yeah, how often you hold these markets throughout the year as well?
Yeah, so March is going to come round really quick. We don't have markets in January and February just because it's so bitterly cold and dark and damp over in Fife. as everywhere else. So March the 9th and 10th will be our first one back, and we are focusing on Grow Your Own. So we will be hosting workshops around planting, maybe some garden workshops, some kid activities, anything that kind of sparks an interest in producing your own food. And it might be from creating food in like a window box to having your own little veg pot, your veg plot or something like that in your own garden. So we'll be trying to get people hands-on, muddy, messy where possible, and obviously a big market hall full of lovely produce as well. So yeah, that's going to come around really quick, and hopefully lots of people will join us.
To round off my delicious journey through Fife, I make my way back to King's Barnes. A few years ago, whiskey wasn't really a big thing in Fife, but these days there are five distilleries producing lowland whiskey here. One of them is King's Barnes Distillery, and I'm here for a taste test. But first, my guide Michael takes me on a whistle-stop tour through the history of whiskey and gin and the way that it's made. We wander through the herb garden where students of the gin school can pick their own botanicals. I stick my nose in a washback, filling my nostrils with the scent of active yeast. And I listen to Michael's stories about the development of the distillery, the family who owns it, and the people who work here. My favourite story is about Dorothy.
This is Dorothy, and Dorothy is named after two old ladies, one living in King's Barnes, one living in Quail. We're right in the middle between those two locations. And they used to come here when it was still a ruin of a farm and have picnics on the grass. When we then started building, they would snoop around the place, and we could see them on CCTV at night, just, you know, in the evening, walking around, having a little nosy like old ladies do. They weren't that old then. But then they still come to our cafe about 3-4 times a week now. They're both named Dorothy, so we named the still Dorothy in their honour. Right, good score.
The tour goes on, and Michael starts pouring me drinks. I try the gin, the new mixed spirit, and of course as well, the whiskey. And just like the taste of that sweet dram lingers on my tongue long after the tour is over, I think about the experiences I've had on this trip to Fife. The history I've discovered, the adventures I've had, the tastes I've enjoyed, and the people I met. They all form the layers of what makes Fife so special. They are the icons of the kingdom, where your journey of discovery begins. I hope you enjoyed this story about my winter trip to Fife. Another thing I love about this region of Scotland is how easily accessible it is. There are great train and bus connections all across Fife, and the journey times between villages are never too long. Fife is super close to Glasgow and Edinburgh, making it the perfect first location on your Scotland trip, or an ideal place if you only have a few days to spare, or on those shorter winter days. If you're listening to this episode as it comes out, check out the ongoing events of the Snowdrop Festival at Cambo Gardens, which includes guided walks through the woodlands and special talks about snowdrops. It's an annual event, so if you miss this year's festival, you always have a chance again next year. If you feel inspired to plan a trip to Fife yourself, you can find lots of resources for this in the full show notes on our website. You'll find a list of all the places and businesses I mentioned in this episode, as well as links to the five travel guides over on my Scotland travel blog, watchmesee.com. To hear more of my stories from Fife, scroll back a little in our feed and listen to Yours to Explore, a travel story about Dunfermline and West Fife, and Step by Step, a story from season 2 about hiking along the 5 coastal path. If you're curious about how we produced this episode and how it came to sound the way it sounds, join me now in my Patreon community. I'll be sharing some behind-the-scenes photos from my trip, and in this month's bonus episode, I'm sharing some of the longer conversations I recorded to explain how we pick what we include in the final edit of the show. You can find the link to join in the show notes. And with this, I send you off to plan your own trip to Fife and discover its layers of history, adventure, and deliciousness. We'll be back soon with another special episode about an archaeology-inspired trip to South Scotland. Make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss it. Thank you so much for listening to Wild for Scotland. We love telling stories that are truly inspiring, so if any of our episodes have ever inspired you to visit a certain location, support a sponsor, or change something about the way you look at the world, we'd love to hear from you. Leave a review or post about it on social media and tag us. Thank you so much. Wild for Scotland is part of the Tremula Network, adventure and outdoor podcasts off the beaten path. The show is written and hosted by me, Kathy Kamleitner. Thanks to Fran Tarowskis, who is the co-producer and editor and does the sound design. Michelle Payne and Anesima Tanda Mambingo are supporting the podcast and Tremula Network with social media. Podcast art is by Lizzie Vaughan Knight, and all original music is composed by Bruce Wallace. Until next time, when we travel to a different place in Scotland. If you're still here, listening all the way to the very end, it means you've probably got your hands full. So let me take this opportunity to remind you that I don't just write immersive travel stories. I also plan unforgettable itineraries for Scotland. And it's never been easier to follow one of my routes. Head to watchmesee.com/shop to browse my ready-made Scotland itineraries and turn your travel dreams into reality.